And welcome to this edition of the Healthy Planet radio program as part of Natural Alternatives. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for the best hour of your life. That's right, the one that's always in front of you, wherever you are, whenever you are, right now. The Healthy Planet focuses on topics that will hope to educate you about the deep connections among all life on Earth and the powerful effects your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world. Well, we're still celebrating Earth Month here at The Healthy Planet, and in honor of that, we're very pleased to have with us the director of the new hit Netflix documentary, Seaspiracy. His name is Ali Tabrizi. If you haven't heard about Seaspiracy, I would strongly recommend you look it up, and if you're a Netflix person, watch it and take notes. This is a film that has been among the top Netflix movies since its recent release, and whether you know it or not, this is a very good thing for you, for me, and for all life on Earth. And you'll hear why I'm saying that in the coming hour. As with any movie that strikes powerfully at an issue that needs to be discussed, and this one does need to be discussed, it's raising its share of controversy and pushback from everyone from fishing organizations to environmental groups, ocean groups, and more. With that said, Seaspiracy is one of those eye-opening films that needed to be made, and whose time has come. And I say that because of where our society's come in the last few years. With the awareness that was being built for decades, we're finally getting to a point where we're coming to grips with the fact that raising and eating of land-based animals is not only leading us to premature death, but it's devastating our environment, wasting our natural resources, including food, at a time when tens of millions of people are dying of malnutrition and related diseases. And on top of that, we're finally starting to collectively awaken to the fact that we don't really want to rely upon foods that necessarily rely upon being violent toward animals. So now we can get meals that are entirely as delicious and have the same qualities as the animal foods, but we have substitutes. So in the midst of this awakening about land-based animals comes Seaspiracy, which is certainly something that is going to contribute to the process of extending that awareness beyond the land animals and the land ecosystem, and now to the sea animals and the marine ecosystem. Welcome, Ali Tabrizi, and I'll say congratulations on the film's release and its initial success, with it being one of the top three films on Netflix. That's rather amazing.
Yeah, thank you. It's completely taken us by surprise. We're a small team of filmmakers, and when we finished up making the film, we thought, okay, great, we're done. This will make a small little impact in the ocean conservation community, and it will live somewhere on the Netflix, you know, platform. And so, you know, within 48 hours, it was trending top 10. And I think over the last few days, I mean, it reached the number one spot in something like 7 countries, including the UK, Hong Kong, Singapore, Malta, in the films category, and overall within top 10, I think in close to 50 countries. And so we were completely not surprised and just blown away.
That's great. And of course, it's good news, not just for us, because I've been covering this issue for several decades, and you for having made the film, but it's good news because this is something that, if there's a more important issue than this on this planet, tell me about it.
Yeah,
this
exactly.
Is it. So yeah, awareness of the most important issue on this planet and having a film maintain that level of success is what we need. It's what we all really need. We literally need it.
Absolutely. It's given us so much hope because, you know, as I said, like, we weren't expecting that people would be ready for a film like this. You know, it really is kind of breaking the rules a little bit. And to see that we've reached a demographic of not only environmentalists who care about this issue, but, you know, grandparents, kids, neighbors, people at school, people are messaging us from all corners of the world in different demographics. And it just shows, you know, people are ready. People are ready for an authentic message and want to hear the truth. So it's been amazing.
People are ready. With the awareness that's grown around eating of animals and the impacts that that creates, there's also the growing awareness and youth involvement in climate change. And so all of that is creating a wave, if you will, that is going someplace. And I've been doing this for several decades, and now this is different. What we're seeing over the last few years is different.
Yeah, I agree. It's been like a tipping point over the last even 2 years.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you didn't just happen to make this documentary on this topic because someone said, hey, why don't you make a documentary on this? Sounds like a good topic. The ocean has held a very special place in your heart for many years since youth. Right. Talk a bit about that.
Yeah. I mean, growing up, I was from the southeast coast of England, and I grew up watching David Attenborough on TV and having his movies light up our room with all the colors of the ocean and all these wild animals. And, you know, when I'd look out the window, all I'd see were pigeons and seagulls, you know, nothing very, very exciting. So for me, adventure was always out there somewhere, and I just wanted to be able to go and see it one day. And always had a fascination with cameras, and I was always with a camera. And the two sort of naturally led together, wanting to become a filmmaker one day, and with a passion for the environment, it just seemed to like lead me down this path. And so that was really a big passion of mine growing up. And I never would have dreamed that eventually make an ocean documentary myself. But when I started to see what was happening to our ocean, whether through news articles or even just on the beaches where I lived with whales washing up and in their stomachs was plastic, it made me realize, well, hold on, that the ocean isn't just this romantic place where just, you know, beautiful filmmakers go down and just get all this great footage. It's in trouble. And it's a side of the story that wasn't really getting much coverage at the time of when I started this. And so I took a deep dive in that direction and went down a rabbit hole.
Yeah. And we're glad you did. Now, in 2019, the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services released one of the most comprehensive reports ever completed on biodiversity on our planet. And the report concluded that, and I quote, nature is declining globally at rates unprecedented in human history. And the rate of species extinctions is accelerating, with grave impacts on people around the world now likely. The chair of the organization that produced this report also stated, and I quote, the health of the ecosystems on which we and all other species depend on is deteriorating more rapidly than ever. We are eroding the very foundations of our economies, livelihoods, food security, health, and quality of life worldwide. The report stated that on lands, this was largely driven by animal agriculture, which we've covered extensively on this show. And in marine ecosystems, direct exploitation of organisms, mainly fishing, has had the largest relative impact. And your film, Seaspiracy, builds that case in a way that's easy to understand, and that certainly is captivating. It keeps your attention. So talk about what you found to be the leading threat to our oceans.
Yeah, I think like most people, I grew up thinking, you know, well, first of all, the oceans were indestructible. I never could imagine that something like the oceans, which cover 70% of our Earth and has something like 80% of all life in it, could ever be in a state of crisis.
Right.
But when I did become aware of the problems, it seemed to be plastic and climate change. They seemed to be the leading threats in the newspapers. And so when I really started making this film, started looking at the threats, that's really where I thought the journey would take me. I thought it'd be mostly a climate change documentary. But by the time I was, you know, a good year into the project, and we started to know that actually those issues, plastic and climate change, tend to be more like exacerbators of a problem rather than the direct threat to the biodiversity itself right now. So if you look at the leading cause of species loss in our ocean, habitat loss, the decimation of these beautiful, intricate, delicate ecosystems, it's undeniably the fishing industry. There's just no question about it. Wherever you are in the world, it's the fishing industry is number one. And the other two are you know, second or third down there, but the fishing industry is really leading the way. And that was really a surprise to me.
Absolutely. And it's a surprise to everybody because, again, this has been under the radar for a long time. Despite the fact that it's been discussed, we've discussed the ocean problems on this show in a variety of ways, ranging from one end that you covered, Oceana, to the other end, Jonathan Balcombe, and looking at the abilities and hidden abilities and intelligence of fish that are in the ocean, sea life, things that we never would have imagined. And we didn't know because we weren't studying it. So here we are now making the round turn to where we are with your film, just putting it all together.
Yeah, we really tried to cover as many issues as possible in this film. I think that's what some people are quite surprised by, is just how much we managed to pack into this film. So far, lots of great films on the ocean have included, the shark finning issue, or what happens in Taiji, or what's happening to coral reefs and plastic. But we really wanted to piece together all these parts of the puzzle to try and what is try and find out what is the main narrative, what is the main issue that's happening to our ocean, and do these seemingly disconnected issues interconnect some way. And we found that, whether it be the shark finning issue, we found that actually most sharks are being caught in fish in industrial fishing vessels. And when it comes to the whaling of dolphins and whales, well, actually more whales and dolphins and porpoises are dying as bycatch in fishing nets as well. And when it came to the plastic issue, we learned that, well, hold on, a huge amount of plastic waste is coming from the fishing industry in the form of fishing nets, gear, ropes, lines, hooks, all those fish traps. And they're washing up on beaches and they're swirling around the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. It's probably 46% fishing nets in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, and the majority of the rest of it is other types of fishing gear. In Europe, all the beaches, 41% of the plastic by weight on European beaches is fishing nets and other types of gear. This is a huge problem that for so long hasn't really been talked about. It's been mostly about, cotton buds and plastic straws and those kinds of consumer issues, which is important. We do need to tackle those issues. But let's address the biggest whale in the room, and it has to come about through acknowledging that the fishing industry and its waste is a huge part of the problem in our seas.
Absolutely. And that is one of the hidden messages because, again, it has been. I've known a lot of environmental groups that are focusing on plastics in the oceans. They're not focusing on the ghost fishing gear. They're
No.
focusing on, as you mentioned, the straws and the plastic bags, plastic bottles, which also need to be dealt with. Just last week, I read an interview with Shauna Swan, a professor of environmental medicine and public health at Mount Sinai in New York City. And she explained how chemicals and plastic are causing human fertility to decline. In 2017, she documented how average sperm counts among Western men have more than halved in the past 40 years. And in her new book called Countdown, she said that, and I quote, "Most couples may have to use assisted reproduction by 2045." So the plastics problem that you mentioned and that is gone into in your film extensively is a really serious threat, not just because it looks bad in the oceans and it kills fish and it kills other animals there, but it is a direct threat to human survival. Then the
Exactly.
microplastics, it just continues, it goes on and
Yeah,
on.
absolutely. It's a huge issue. And these, again, like this, these microplastics do come from consumer goods, but they also come from the fishing nets and the fishing fibers. And it's all ending up in pretty much every marine animal, from all the way from a whale to a fish to zooplankton. It's ending up everywhere. It's a huge problem.
And you spent a good part of your film going into the fact that environmental organizations and plastics organizations are not covering the issue the way perhaps they would if they were going about it in a completely clear, forthright manner in highlighting, like what we like to do. I like to talk about what the things that you can do that have the largest impact are first.
Right,
Put those first.
exactly.
Then we talk about things like recycling the piece of paper on your desk, but the things that are the biggest things, what you're eating, how you're heating your house, how you're powering your house, those are the things that deserve a lot of our attention. And
Right.
so we're talking about here what we're eating. Let's talk a little
Absolutely.
bit about what you found with the other organizations.
Yeah, so as the film progressed, we realized that, well, hold on, the fishing industry is probably it is the leading threat to our oceans on all fronts. Why aren't the environmental organizations championing this at the forefront of their websites, their campaigns, all over social media? Why wasn't this front page news? We've all seen that sea turtle that was tragically had that straw in its nose and it went viral, but the world doesn't know about the amount of turtles that die in fishing nets every year. It's barely published. It's barely talked about. So many people are so shocked by it in the movie. So when we went to some of these organizations and just asked them, hey, is there a reason why it's not on the website? Were you aware of this? We were met with some pretty unusual backlash and quite frankly took us by surprise and asked to turn the cameras off. And we have no idea why. And the analogy that I always say, it's like, look, if you're a cancer specialist dealing with lung cancer, you'd want to address at the forefront cigarette smoking as the absolute first thing you tackle when you're trying to address the problem. This would be the same thing with the plastic organizations. If we're talking about plastic pollution in our ocean, at least mention the fishing nets and the fishing gear problem, the ghost nets. But time and time again, these organizations just didn't have it on their website. And some of that made it into the film.
And we saw the same thing with climate change. For the longest time, the top environmental climate change organizations, including Al Gore's, weren't mentioning food. Like, Al, this is the big issue. You need to go there. Eventually they did.
Right.
But now, it's interesting that one of the organizations that you were dealing with in the film, Oceana, has posted a response. And one of the things they said, as a rebuttal to some of the questions you were asking in the film, they said, why not just stop eating fish? That's what they asked. And this is the answer they gave. And I quote, "People have the right to choose what they eat, and adopting a vegan diet is a choice that some of us can make. Unfortunately, it's not a realistic choice for hundreds of millions of people around the world who depend on coastal fisheries, many of whom are also facing poverty, hunger, and malnutrition," end quote. Now, to me, that argument is like saying we shouldn't stop killing people unnecessarily in the United States, because there are parts of the country and in the world where wars and gangs make killing absolutely necessary.
Right, right. It's absolutely absurd. It's unbelievable and such a nothing statement, in my opinion. I mean, look, we ask straightforward questions in these organizations, and I guess rarely ever have they been asked this question. We never said vegan. Yep. We never said vegetarian. We just said, hey, as the world's leading marine conservation organization, and they're doing great work in many areas, why is on the top things you can do for ocean, why isn't it even mentioned that, hey, you know, reducing or eliminating seafood consumption should be an option? You know, you should even just say it there, not to force people to do anything, just to let them know this is a viable option. And you know what? It's a far simpler option to understand and go along with, because in our interviews, they said, well, look, there's really no definition for sustainable fishing. Consumers find it really, really hard to understand what sustainable fishing is. Some fisheries that were labeled sustainable end up not being sustainable. And so to me, it was just absolutely unbelievable why it wasn't just even briefly mentioned that a really simple way to just reduce, really like eliminate our impact on our oceans when it comes to fishing would be just, hey, let's just reduce and eliminate what's there on our plates. So absolutely shocking. Yeah.
Yeah, it is shocking. It reminds me of several years ago, I had the opportunity to be in an event with Bill McKibben. And I asked him, look, animal production, the livestock production and the eating of animals is one of the main contributors to climate change. He says, why don't you cover this? And the answer that he gave me was something to the effect that people have to eat and we can't tell people what to eat. And that's similar to, I think the Plastic Pollution Coalition said. And at face value, that could make sense. Yeah, it's true, you can't tell people what to eat. But when you consider that these organizations continuously tell people what to do, what cars to drive, what not to use plastic bags or straws, not to wash your clothes in hot water, you know? Not to drive an inefficient car, but no, it can't tell you what to eat.
So, yeah, it's absolutely shocking. It never ceases to amaze me how the lengths that people go to say, whoa, you can't say that. You can't tell people what to do when it comes to their food choices, but we can tell them to completely change the way their homes are powered, our cities, our countries are powered, and what plastic bags are used. I mean, it's amazing, because in the film, we spoke to the head of the European Union Commissioner of Fisheries and the Environment and made this point to him and said, hey, look, when it comes to plastic pollution, you know, we can all agree that we need to reduce and eliminate our consumption of it and find better alternatives. So why don't we just make the same observation, especially when we have the world scientists and marine conservationists behind us on this, when we made the same observation about the consumption of fish, why don't we just acknowledge that, yeah, we should reduce and eliminate it from our diets and find better alternatives. And, you know, time and time again, these people just turn around as if you just ask them like the strangest question. So yeah, it just kept on taking me by surprise every time I was doing these interviews. And
And it's a question that you would think would be well within the realm of what they address on a regular basis, since that is their field.
Right. That's the entire purpose why their organization is set up.
Exactly.
Doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make sense, no.
Yeah, and often I think that there could be vested interests involved. I think, especially when it came to animal agriculture years ago, like a lot of these big environment groups were either getting funding from the meat lobbies and those industries, or were directly involved in it. I don't know if I read an article about Al Gore years ago that maybe he had like a cattle ranch or something. I don't know if that's exactly true, but don't quote me on that. But there can be these sort of vested interests involved in it, and it can be, you know, hard when someone challenges them on something, when they're so used to challenging everyone else, you know?
Yeah. I'd say it's vested interests. And we see that with environmental groups who don't want to offend their membership. And so they stay away from these hot topics like what you should eat. Yeah. And also it has to do, I think, with just the desire to not change, to maintain the status quo. I worked in creating healthy school lunches, and it was harder to get a healthful change made, something that we knew would extend the life of kids and their health for their entire lifetimes. It was harder getting something like that changed than it was to add a junk food to the menu. You could add a junk food to the menu because it was within the norm. You know, don't take hot dogs off the menu, but we don't want those healthful foods because it's just a change. It's different. And people defend their past and what they've done in the past as if that's who they are. And so it's challenging their survival.
Absolutely. And you know what, when it comes to the Oceana statement about that it's this unrealistic that, you know, the people around the world, the hundreds of millions of people around the world are going to, you know, take note on this message to reduce and eliminate. I mean, well, what do they expect about, you know, there are other messages about wanting to eat sustainable. I mean, not everywhere you can get sustainable. It's hard to pass out. But also, one of the things that this film has, that the response from this film has shown, is that hundreds of millions of people, or if not the people that we've sort of had messages from, the millions of people are ready to make that change. They just didn't know about it. And it costs nothing to put that on your website. It takes 10 seconds, write something out on the to-do page. One of the things you can do is to reduce and eliminate seafood consumption, or even just shift towards a plant-based diet. So it does shock me that they're willing to say that it's an unrealistic goal to have. But these organizations are set out to change the world and to try and make the world a bigger place. I mean, why set your bar so low? So it doesn't make sense.
Right. And I think one of the things you said about people are willing to make the change now, that's different now. And I think part of that has to do with the fact that there are alternatives that give them the same taste and the same mouthfeel and even a better health experience. So they can say, they can finally admit, I'd rather not kill an animal. Right. I'd rather not destroy the oceans to have a meal. And now that I could eat this and it tastes the same as this, I'm free to do it. And that's where we are right now, I believe.
So basically, you know, I do put out like an open invitation to Oceana. If they ever want to just put that on the website, we'll congratulate them. We'll share it all over our social media. Any other organization that wants to put this on their website, we welcome it. And we want to work together with these groups. But first of all, we need to get the story straight. What's the leading threat to our oceans? And what's the most simple, powerful, effective thing we can all do in our daily lives? And we present that information in our movie. And so we're welcoming any other organization that wants to come forward and sort of join us on this.
Great. And yes, these organizations, including the ones I mentioned with 350.org and Al Gore's and all the others, they're doing amazing work with a lot of dedication. So it's not to take away from the other messages that they're giving, but it is to say, as you said, let's be clear. Let's be clear about what the main threats here are and be on the same page and work toward the same ends.
Absolutely.
So the film states that global fish catch is 2.7 trillion fishes per year. And that's up to 5 million fishes killed per minute, 5 million per minute, impacting countless species of sea life. Now, the film powerfully makes the point that many of these intelligent sea creatures, the whales, the dolphins, the sharks, play a really important role in promoting actual life in our world's oceans. And not just life for the life in the oceans, but life for the world, as I mentioned earlier. I'd like you to take a little time to paint a picture of some of the really amazing abilities and in the important roles that some of these creatures play in stabilizing our environments, as well as some of what you found when investigating what's happening to the whales, dolphins, sharks at the hands of commercial fishing. And start with whales, since that your film kind of started with mention of whales and their bellies being filled with plastics and them washing up on beaches.
Whales are incredible creatures. You know, like the blue whale, I think gives off something like three tons of manure a day. And it's filled with iron and other nutrients that phytoplankton really need in order for them to continue their life cycle of pulling in carbon and giving off oxygen. Some reports show that up to 80%, in the region of 80% of the world's oxygen comes from phytoplankton. And so when we remove these incredible creatures that are not only emotionally complicated and complex and have great social lives, but playing an important role in how the ocean works, we are really tearing away the foundations of life in our oceans. What I learned was that it's not just the whales that are doing that and the dolphins, but it's also the sharks. The sharks are maintaining the entire ecosystem. They make sure that these fish don't overpopulate and basically eat away all of their feed. And so when you have healthy shark populations, you really have healthy fish populations and you have healthy marine plant populations. And so sharks are incredibly vital too. The same goes for fish. I learned that one of the things that didn't make it into the film was that fish in our oceans actually help combat acidification. Something to do with the bicarbonate in their urine, and it helps neutralize the acidity of the ocean. And so when we remove these animals from the ocean, we are really playing a big role in the carbon cycle and the oxygen cycle, and actually boost the acidity of our oceans. And so time and time again, the more you looked into it, you realized that actually each of these species are just so complex that for us to go through with this huge net and rip everything out so with such destruction, you know, with such levels of destruction and such quantity, that we have no idea what we're actually causing on the ecosystem level and the services they provide. And so sometimes it's just too late and we've wrecked those ecosystems and they're no longer bouncing back because we've just completely demolished it to the ground when it comes to bottom trawling. But these species are all vital. When it comes to marine plants like kelp and seagrass, they can absorb something like 20 times more carbon than rainforests on land. And even though they only occupy a small percentage of the Earth's oceans, they're actually providing huge amounts of carbon sequestration for our Earth. So I was absolutely blown away by all these things that I never knew about marine life. And it's really sad to see it disappear. We have no idea what we're losing, and we're losing it faster than we can even appreciate what they do and how they exist in our oceans.
Yeah, the oceans are keeping us alive and we're decimating the ocean without even knowing it.
Mm.
You mentioned the nets, the large nets. Talk a little bit about some of those nets and some of those miles long lines and how these animals are taken from the ocean.
Yeah,
I really think that most people don't understand how fishing is done. They have a fish on their plate. They think it's, you know, Captain Joe who went out and caught it for them, as the film points out, but it is not.
Right. Yeah. As George Monbiot in the film describes, you know, these are death machines. These are huge industrial fishing fleets that cost hundreds of millions of dollars. They have ex-military fishing, ex-military technology to track down every last fish in our oceans. And they use these huge nets that some of them can contain, you know, they could swallow up something like 13 jumbo jets that are that big. And they drag these heavy weights to the bottom of the seafloor, which bulldoze everything. They kill all the marine life down there. They bulldoze all the corals and the marine plants, and they catch everything. And when you add up all the seafloor that these trawling vessels just pillage every single year all around the world, it equates to about 3.9 billion acres. Which, comparatively speaking, if you add up the amount of acres that deforestation destroys, it's somewhere in the region of 25 million acres. 3.9 billion acres is absolutely unfathomable quantities of seafloor, and it's vital ecosystem that's just being demolished. And that was really, like, that was one of the most shocking findings when doing this film, is just understanding what goes on beneath the surface of the sea. It's out of sight, out of mind, you can't see it. And when it comes to longlining, you know, these fishing vessels that drag these sometimes 100-mile, 50-mile lines behind them with thousands upon thousands of hooks. And in a single night, the world's longline vessels set enough fishing line to wrap around the Earth 500 times. They indiscriminately catch sharks, turtles, albatross, fish, marlin, all these different species so indiscriminately. And yet, for the longest time, we've just not known about it. It's happening all around the Earth. And they're indiscriminately catching everything. And finally, we've been able to shine a light on this. And now people are becoming aware of just how destructive the fishing industry is.
Yeah. And it does a good job. The film does a good job of it. And again, it takes you in, pulls you in emotionally as well. One of the areas you covered were the Faroe Islands, where they say it's sustainable, quote unquote, whaling. And just the sounds of the whales, the shoreline red with blood, the most gruesome violence that one can imagine. And then showing the eye of the whale itself, you know, there's a creature there. It's not just something. First of all, what a horrible job it was for you at times to make this film. I can't even imagine you having to deal with all of the violence that you saw in doing this. First of all, let's go right to that. How was that? Did it scar you? How was it in the moment?
I mean, it was a shock to the system. When we were on the Faroe Islands, it doesn't happen at a routine time. So it could happen at any time during the year. And so we decided to go there for 10 days. And just if something happened, we were there to document it. On the 10th day, I said to Lucy, the co-director, and my wife as well, that, look, we need to extend our trip because I'd hate to miss this and actually, you know, lose the chance of documenting this. And so we extended our flight. And the very next day when we were meant to get our flight, we got the call. Basically, on the other side of the islands, the fishermen had spotted a pod of whales, and we're now starting to herd them in. So we manically drove over there, a trip that would usually take about 2 hours. We did it in about 45 minutes, and we rushed over there to try and document it. We got there, walked down to the beach, which at the time we had heard that it was illegal for non-Danish citizens to be on the beach because they'd had quite a lot of activists in the past from Sea Shepherd show up there. So they were skeptical to foreigners with cameras. And so we managed to sneak on before police turned up. I don't know if they've changed the laws now, but we managed to sneak on. And within a few moments, the whales had been herded into this small fjord. And the water was very, very shallow, and the boats were banging poles on the side of the boats to try and create a sound wall that would drive the whales onto the beach. And before we knew it, herds, you know, huge amounts of people were rushing into the ocean to try, you know, to basically put a hook through these whales' blowholes, pull them up onto the beach and lance them and slice their neck open. Now, the Faroe Islands claim that they have taken measures to do so-called humane slaughter of these animals by lancing their spinal cord, and then butchering them. Time and time again on the beach, we found that they were not spearing them. They were not using the so-called humane practices, which, by the way, when I did see it, it didn't look humane at all. And
it's like, Mr. Jones, we are going to kill your son, but we're going to do it in a humane manner. So don't worry about it.
Yeah, no,
it's
exactly.
It's just a crazy concept. You
and these murder. Exactly. And these are incredibly sensitive, emotionally complex beings who will not leave another member of their pod behind. They will, if one of them beaches, they all beach themselves. They're very, very connected. And so, yeah. So what witnessing that was absolutely heart wrenching. And as you said, the waters turned red with their blood, and we filmed a lot of that. We had like hours of footage, and only probably a minute of it made it into the film because we couldn't show all of that in the film. We couldn't show all the graphic stuff. There were pregnant whales being butchered, and afterwards seeing these baby whales on the beach just dead, and just being able to touch them and just see how that, you know, they were alive just a few moments ago, and now they're laying there in the pool of their own blood, and it was absolutely horrible. But yeah, it was unbelievable to witness, and graphic and emotionally scarring. But when we had an interesting interview with the whaler later on that day, next day, it was the most surreal interview because he pointed out, look, hey, you may think I'm the most evil guy in the world right now, but I kill these whales and they provide meat for us for months. Everyone else around the world is calling us evil, and yet they are paying for billions of land animals and trillions of marine animals to be slaughtered every year for their food. And so it was a really pivotal moment in the film where it's actually a whaler who talks to me about a moral compass and the hypocrisy of, you know, killing one animal and you know, being so upset about it when really we're all consuming all these other animals and not thinking twice about it.
Yeah, he made a really good point. He said, killing one whale, you otherwise would be killing 200 chickens.
Yeah, 2,000 chickens. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Four people can kill 2 to 3 salmon. Mm. So yeah, his point is correct. Now, of course, you can take the point and say, well, then I'll just continue to eat everything. You could say, oh yeah, you are raising the point of why I should be killing. Yeah.
And of course, you know, we all acknowledge that whales are incredible beings in the ecosystem. And you wouldn't say, well, killing an ant is the same as a whale. You know, that's a gray area when it comes to morality, but
it is.
What's incredible to think about along with this is that, well, when you do catch those fish, you could also be killing many other whales and dolphins in the process, and turtles and all this bycatch. And those beings play a vital role in the ecosystem. And in fact, they are the food of the whales and the dolphins. And so when you're eating that squid or those shrimp or whatever else it is, that is the natural food source for these incredible beings that we all like to love, the dolphins, the whales, the turtles, the, you know, and even the large fish. And so we're kind of taking their food away. And we've really seen that impact on the penguin populations and how their food source is being diminished because we're eating all their food. So it was an incredible moment in the interview.
Hmm. Yeah. Interesting that it came from a whaler.
Yeah.
So let's shift a little bit to dolphins here. You know, everybody knows them, loves them. They're intelligent. They're cute. And you would think that humans would never do to them what we are actually doing to them. So talk a little bit about what's happening to dolphins and go into somewhat of what happened at Taiji, what you filmed and what goes on there.
Mm. Yeah, so Taiji is one of the first places we visit in the film because we all have started to become aware in recent years about the Japanese hunting of dolphins. And how a lot of these dolphins are ending up in marine parks, and it's highly lucrative industry. And in these marine parks, these dolphins endure such torture for years. And unfortunately, it looks like they have a natural smile. We think they're happy when actually they're incredibly depressed. They're drugged up and essentially made to perform tricks in order to eat. It's a very, very sad state of affairs for captured dolphins in marine parks. But when we were there, we also learned that, well, for every one dolphin that's captured in Taiji and put into marine parks, 12 others are killed. And so we raised the question, well, you know, dead dolphins don't perform tricks. They're no use to SeaWorld, these dead dolphins. And so when we looked into why they were killing them, we found it was a bit of a sort of scapegoat for the fishermen in Taiji to basically justify continuing their overfishing, because they say that the dolphins are the reason why there's no fish left for them. When in fact, when you look at the local fishing port, just the next town from Taiji in a town called Kikatsura, it's one of the largest tuna ports in the world. And what they're landing there is incredibly lucrative, and they don't want to stop. These populations are overfished. And so they can just keep blaming the dolphins, killing the dolphins, so they can basically hide what they're doing. And so that was a real big reveal for me. Later on in the film, we learn that as bad as that particular town is for the killing of dolphins, it does not compare to the bycatch levels around the world in fisheries. For example, on the west coast of France, there is a small sea bass fishery, I believe it is, that every year catches somewhere in the region of 10 to 11,000 dolphins in just the space of actually a few months of their fishing operations. And so when you compare the attention that Taiji is getting and the hate that they're getting, it really doesn't make sense when you compare it to what's happening in just one small area in France. And this has been happening for 30 years and no one's known about it. And it raises the question, why are we so willing to look at one issue like that, the smaller issue, as important as it is to end? And I'm fully behind supporting, you know, the ending of those captures and those killings. Looking at the bigger picture just makes you realize that this is something that we're all complicit in. This isn't about finger pointing to, you know, those countries over there far away. This is something we're all complicit in. And it was really sad to learn that.
As you mentioned, a lot of dolphins could be killed to get a small number of tunas. Someone from Sea Shepherd said 45 dolphins to catch a tuna they had witnessed.
That's right. Yeah.
And that vessel, here's the kicker. That vessel that killed all those dolphins in order to get a tuna, 45 dolphins, was working for a brand of tuna with a dolphin safe certification label on its can. Talk about a little bit about that label.
This was a real, again, the mantra of this making this film is like, this was shocking. Oh my God.
Yeah, true.
And all through my childhood, dolphin safe tuna was what went in my sandwiches and my school lunches, you know, and I'm someone who's always loved the ocean. And there I am thinking I'm doing something great for the sea and eating those dolphin safe cans of tuna. Little did I know that that label could not guarantee anything. This isn't like an organic label or a non-GMO label or a lactose-free label where, you know, you cannot, I mean, I hope not, I'd have to look into it, but you wouldn't be able to get away with it if, you know, if you had something that was only half sprayed with toxic pesticides or it was only half organic or something
right.
like that.
It's certified.
Right. It was in an uncertain world. You trust that that label has a little bit of certainty, and that's why you pay the premium for that certainty of trying to do something good for the earth and for those animals. Well, these labels, these dolphin safe labels, cannot guarantee anything. And we heard this from their spokesperson, who said that they cannot guarantee it. Not only that, their observers that are meant to be out at sea auditing this process are rarely there. And not only that, their observers can even be bribed and not actually take proper documentation of it. It was an absolute shock to me. And so I just don't know how they've gotten away with it for so long. You know, this is essentially fraud, in my opinion. And for people to become aware of this, I think has been a real shock for everyone. And it still blows my mind just thinking about it, that they cannot guarantee that dolphin safe tuna is in fact dolphin safe.
So consider that next time you're buying a can of tuna and you're looking for that dolphin safe label because you care. You're doing it for the right reason. Now consider the fact that it may not indicate what you hope that it does.
And also not to mention that, you know, the tuna need protecting as well now. You know, we need tuna safe tuna in the form of plant-based alternatives. And exactly. these populations like bluefin and even the other populations, they're diminishing, they're declining. And these species are vital to the marine ecosystem. And so we need to also be caring about those issues as well.
Absolutely. And not just because they're vital to the ecosystem, but because tuna are individuals too. They each have their lives, their social interactions, their own interests. They feel pain the way we do. They are much more complex than we have given them credit for being up until now. So it's the fact that we are getting, having these alternatives come out is just game changing, And people may not like some of the Impossible Burgers being related to GMOs, but then there's Beyond and so many other of these forms of these substitutes that are coming out.
And not only that, you know, you don't have to be buying these synthetic alternatives. You can make plenty of just plant-based alternatives that are very cheap. You can, I mean, one recipe that I've heard is you can use chickpeas and mush them up with the same seasonings as you would with tuna and seaweed and mayonnaise, and you've got yourself a sort of tuna sandwich. And so you don't have to be buying these alternatives, but they're becoming more available. They're becoming cheaper, and more companies are starting to make them.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. And there are some of us, like myself, who haven't eaten tuna in 40 years. And that's not difficult. You know, it's once you decide that that's the way you want to go. I don't want to contribute to this or that or that. You just make the choice and that's it. Nothing difficult about it. But again, these the meat alternatives, a nice stepping stone for those people who don't want to dive into it the way I was ready to.
Yeah.
So all you wanted to do as a kid was shoot beautiful ocean films. What were the most memorably beautiful things that you got to see while you were making this film?
Well, unfortunately, I didn't see as much as I would have hoped, because after making this film, when you start looking into this problem, you realize that the oceans aren't as abundant as you might imagine. When you look at Blue Planet, as these beautiful films, they are flying to the distant corners of the world, to places that are barely touched by human beings, in order to get these shots. You know, they're going to the, you know, North Pole, Alaska, maybe some places right on the tip of South Africa, you know, a few places in Australia, and in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, really, really far away from human activity. But the oceans aren't as abundant as they used to be. And even where I live along the UK coast, along the British Channel, we take for granted that there's just, you know, barely any life there anymore in the forms of large marine mammals, because a couple of hundred years ago, the seas here were teeming with life. There were humpback whales and huge flocks of bird and huge schools of fish that would black out the entire ocean. We just take for granted now that we're living in an ocean in a time where there just really isn't that much abundance in our seas. However, one of the places that I was able to see beautiful marine life swimming freely was off the coast of West Africa. Off the end of the Sea Shepherd boat, the Sam Simon, were out there with Sea Shepherd Conservation Organization Society on their boat, trying to tackle illegal fishing. And they teamed up with the Liberian Coast Guard, offering them their resources, their volunteers, their ship to help the Liberians protect their own waters from illegal fishing. And it's often from European and Chinese subsidized fishing vessels. And so on one hand, you see these huge illegal fishing operations coming into this region where there's this beautiful marine life. And witnessing it firsthand, you realize how important it is that we need to start protecting these regions. And so I was able to witness these pods of dolphins swimming and flying fish that I'd never seen in my entire life. It was beautiful to see, and it really affirmed the message of why I was doing this in the first place, is to try and protect these ecosystems, to protect these incredible beings. You know, when you see them, it takes your breath away. You get excited. It's a little adrenaline rush when you see these animals. And but unfortunately, the places in the world where these animals are swimming freely is declining.
I'll just mention one more fact here because we're running out of time. The film mentions that in the North Sea, typical fishing boats in the 1830s could catch 1 to 2 tons of halibut per day. That's a fishing boat, one fishing boat.
Yeah.
Now, the entire fleet of fishing boats, modern technology fishing boats, are able to catch that same 2 tons collectively per year.
Exactly. Yeah. The halibut in the North Sea, as Professor Callum Robertson, the film suggests, has declined more than 1,000%. One fishing boat in a day catching 1 or 2 tons of this, of halibut. Today, the entire fleet, an entire year, has to put that effort in to catch the same amount. That is representative of what's happening in so many places around the world. And the reason is plain and simple. We're just eating too many fish. And it's what it's doing is it's affecting those marine populations. And it's also affecting the small local fisherman who's off the coast of West Africa or in another island state from being able to support him and his family on a subsistence level. So the best thing that we can do to support those indigenous fishing communities is for us, if we have the privilege and the option to choose something else, is to not choose to eat marine life and actually shift towards a plant-based diet.
Right. And the film goes into some of the slavery that's involved in fishing.
Yeah.
A sentence or two on that?
Yeah, so slavery was something that when we became aware of it, we realized we really needed to speak to people who'd been on these ships. And we managed to track down three individuals who had recently escaped from these fishing vessels and off the coast of Thailand. They were all migrant workers who had come from neighboring countries. And some of them had been at sea for 10 years. One of them recounted to me, and I could smell the alcohol in his breath. He was clearly, self-medicating his troubles with alcohol. And he said he'd been at sea for 10 years, 2 months, and 2 days. Another worker, same similar story for about
You
6 years
remember the
at
number
sea.
of days.
Yeah, he counted them every day. And this is, don't forget, these guys didn't have phones. They couldn't contact their family. They, for all they knew, for their family, they'd been lost, they'd died. And as one of these ex-slaves recounts, he witnessed people being thrown overboard and, watching their bodies float on the water surface days later and feeling sorry that their parents would never know about their son's death. These are the workers out there catching cheap seafood to go on supermarkets around the world. And if also catching the feed fish that get ground up and fed to the farmed shrimp, which also ends up on our supermarket shelves. And it was really, really tragic to hear that story. And but this, remember, this isn't something that only happens in Thailand or Southeast Asia. Slavery and fishing vessels have been documented in something like 47 countries. Even Western countries, there's a case that happened off the coast of Ireland in the and so this is a global issue, and the economics of it is there, because what happens is when you have diminishing returns on fishing effort, the captain has his bottom line to meet. He has to pay for the fuel of the ship and the maintenance of the ship and the fishing licenses. About the only way that he can really cut his costs is on the labor. And so by kidnapping individuals and tricking them onto these boats to work in forced labor and in debt, he's able to meet his bottom line. And there's stories of these individuals being kept at sea for years upon years, if not decades, and being put on an island in a cage while the boat goes back to harbor to offload the fish and then come back and take them again.
Wow.
There's stories of a slave escaping, jumping ship, swimming towards the shore, running inland to the local town, going to the police officer, asking for help, only to be captured by the police officer and put into forced labor on the policeman's farm.
Oh.
This is a structural issue of oppression and systematic abuse in several countries. And it's something that is being silenced by some of the countries who have it the worst. Again, this is just something that's happening around the world. It's certainly not in every fishery, but it's certainly something that's happening around the world. And so when people tuck into their fish at night, there is a chance that it was caught by a forced labor slave.
This film presents so many topics to discuss. We could go on for hours, but we are at the end of our time. Ali, closing comments. What you'd like to leave our audience with?
I'd like to leave the audience with some hope. This seems to be a really disconnected and complicated global issue, but the solutions are really simple. We need to personally shift towards less marine life in our diet, optimally a plant-based diet. We need to ask our governments to stop subsidizing these fishing vessels. Every year, about $35 billion goes to these fishing vessels. They're not really operating at a profit a lot of the time, especially on the high seas. They're basically fishing for subsidies, not really the fish anymore. And that money could go to a litany of things. It could go towards ending world hunger. The United Nations state that only $30 billion is needed to end world hunger. It could go to hospitals and nurses. It could go to education. But instead, it goes to destroying our oceans and the life within it. We need to end it. And then lastly, we need to make sure that governments could even put that funding into protecting our oceans, with the goal of protecting 30% of our oceans by the year 2030, creating no-catch sanctuaries where marine life can rebound again. And people can learn more about this on our website, www.seaspiracy.org, and on our Instagram at Seaspiracy, where we continue to put out educational content and to create campaigns around this to raise more awareness.
www.cspiracy.org. And we will put that site as well as other resource sites on the archive for this show. Ali Tabrizi, director, Seaspiracy. We've covered a lot of what's in the film, but there is a lot more. And I really implore you to go see this film, because as I said, there is no larger issue that we can directly have an impact on than what's happening to our oceans. And this film, Seaspiracy, will fill you in on a lot of what's going on in the oceans, and it will give you fodder for whether you choose to continue eating fish or whether you don't. You will at least be informed. So thank you, Ali, for being with us.
Thank you very much. It's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Ali Tabrizi, director of the new Netflix film, Seaspiracy. You can get more information on Seaspiracy and this issue on Seaspiracy.org. That's Seaspiracy as in conspiracy, .org. And again, it's one of the top films on Netflix. See it. To wrap this up, I'd like to state a couple of points, and in some cases, reiterate a couple of points. First, a film about the destruction of the oceans and the trillions of sea creatures that are killed each year to please our palates is so incredibly important and so incredibly timely, since the health of our oceans is intricately tied to the health of our climate. And the climate clock is ticking. If we're going to act in a way that enables our society to avoid the very worst impacts of climate change, the vast majority of our very best scientific experts are telling us that we need to start now and act decisively. Anybody who tells you otherwise is probably getting educated by politicians, and those politicians are either the least informed people on the planet when it comes to climate change or the most dishonest, since I'm very doubtful that they don't know the truth, regardless of what they tell you. Second, one takeaway that some are coming away from this film with is that some of the non-governmental organizations or NGOs who work on issues related to protecting the oceans are dishonest or bad or unscrupulous and not worthy of our support. I think it's unfortunate that that's happening, because many of these groups are doing critically important work to protect our oceans from us. So let's not direct our anger at them. There is a however here, and that is that there is a long history in the environmental movement of ignoring the impact of our diets on the problems at hand. We touched a little bit upon that in this interview. Somehow, for some reason, organizations who do incredible work and give us all kinds of suggestions about not using plastic bottles, not using plastic bags or straws, still see telling us to cut back on our consumption of seafood as being off limits. That's not okay. As Ali has said both in the film and in the interview that we just had, all it would take to correct this is a few lines on their website that acknowledge the pivotal role of commercial fishing on the massive loss of biodiversity in our oceans, and how part of the solution is to ask each of us to eat less sea creature. Period. In addition to the education that's raised among the huge audience of seeing this film, and a lot of people are seeing this, it will hopefully spur all ocean protection organizations to include this message in their list of solutions. Some have. It's not that all of them have not mentioned it, but not all of them have mentioned it enough. And as you'll see in the film, once you see it, some actually seem to be uninformed about this aspect of the issue. And finally, I'd like to thank Sea Shepherd Organization, whose mission is to partner with governments from around the world to assist them with the detection and capture of criminal enterprises that are in operation to engage in illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing operations. Their direct action is an inspiration for all of us who are doing education on this topic. You can find out about them at seashepherd.org and even donate to them if you're motivated to do so. And on that note, this is Bob DiBenedetto on The Healthy Planet on WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook, New York. We've been listening to director Ali Tabrizi on the film Seaspiracy. We'll be with you again next on Friday, May 7th, at this same time. That's right, 6 p.m. For more information on Healthy Planet and our radio shows, or if you're interested in having me do a virtual presentation to your school or group, visit our website at www.healthyplanetusa.org or email us to join our mailing list at info@healthyplanetusa.org. Also, like our Facebook page, which is at Healthy Planet USA. When I'm not here, be sure to listen to Natural Alternatives and The Healthy Planet shows every week at this time with great hosts sharing cutting-edge health and environmental information. That's Fridays at 6 p.m. Until next time, stay strong, relax, make your voice heard in this world by continuing to speak up for what's right. Be kind to those around you, including our amazing four-legged friends, our amazing finned and sea swimming friends, and enjoy this beautiful world that we all share. Good night.